Okay, before we start the question period, just a couple of announcements. We want to welcome our TV audience back as well, and I should have done that initially because this is a fairly popular program on Shaw Cable. Next week's session will be a very interesting one, and I just give you a little snippet. Reflections on Nikko Yoko Garden. Since 1942, many Japanese Canadians have been living along the BC coast, were forced by Government of Canada to evacuate to here in southern Alberta. Many stayed in and near Lethbridge, and after the war, came to terms with past wrongs and contributed greatly to the new communities in which they lived. In 1963, civil libertarian Cleo Mowers and a Buddhist minister, Yatsu Kamamura, and tourism promoter Kurt Steiner developed a shared vision for a Japanese garden. And I think a lot of you are familiar with that as the Centennial Project. And so more than a million people from around the world have visited our famous garden to date. And what messages do visitors take home about peace and cross-cultural understanding? Very interesting topic. Our speakers next week will be Bob Hiranaka, whom many of you know, and, of course, Van Christo, who also many of you know. And both of them, as you are well aware, are eminently qualified to speak on that topic. So that will be our topic for next week. All right. At this time, we would invite Paul to come back to the podium. Keep your comments brief. I'm talking now about the asking questions. When you ask your question, identify yourself, keep your comments brief, and your questions to the point. Thank you. And please come up to the microphone here.
Just looking for a flat spot to put my coffee. Here we go.
My name is David Amies. I'm fairly newly arrived here in Lethbridge. 40 years ago, I studied Coleridge's
principle of war in order to go to a Royal Air Force Staff College. These principles briefly say that if you do go to war, you should know what you're fighting about. You should have sufficient means to prosecute the war successfully, and you ought to have a successful aim. I think that we're failing on all of these. We're told George Bush wants to impose democracy on the Afghanistanis. We should remember it took the West about 2,000 years to learn the lessons of the ancient Greeks. Universal suffrage has only been a fact in the West for 80 years and in Switzerland for less than 30. The British tried it in Africa and proudly left behind a dozen or so so-called democracies, which turned into dictatorships as soon as their backs were turned. The USA sees the Afghanistan problem as part of the so-called war on terror. You can't prosecute a war on an idea with planes, guns, and tanks. They see it as part of the war against drugs. This, in my opinion, is a medical problem and not a legal one. And you don't make friends if you blow up a farmer's field and leave him with no crops. So I think we don't know what we're fighting, why, or how we should go about it. Comments, please.
Well, I think it's certainly true that Afghanistan, we have to look back in history here. In 1979, there were two developments that have given rise to the Afghan situation. In 1979, the Shah fell in Iran and was replaced by the Ayatollah Khomeini, and that regime has been in power ever since. And Iran became a kind of a staging ground for resistance to the American incursions in the Middle East. The second development was in 1989, 10 years later, when the Soviet Union fell. And so those states that had the support from the Soviet Union were no longer in a position to have that support. So what happened was that that much of the resistance to the West in the Middle East migrated to Afghanistan once the Taliban removed the Soviets. And so it's probably legitimate, I think, to suppose that an occupation of Afghanistan would have some salutary effect in the West's war against what some people describe as the West war against Islam, which is basically really what it is. However, it's really difficult to achieve that kind of objective because what's happened is that as the Americans and the Canadians and so on occupy Afghanistan, some of these training camps have simply moved across the border into northern Pakistan, and some of them are now moving back into Iran. So whether or not there was a reasonable hope of success, David, even given that objective, I'm not really sure. The other comment I wanted to make was about democracy was simply this, is that, you know, I teach social and political philosophy. I'm considered to be the political philosopher in the University of Lethbridge. I don't understand the concept of democracy and what we mean by it. I mean, people talk about Israel, for example, as being the democracy, in the Middle East. But, you know, it's a strange concept of democracy. So, first of all, democracy does not apply to one-third of the population under Israeli control, namely the occupied Palestinians have absolutely no democratic rights. The well, yeah, but there are, it's an occupied country, so what is it, you know? The Palestinian Israelis, that is to say the Israelis that were caught behind enemy lines in 1948 and therefore given Israeli citizenship, are second-class citizens. They are not the key ingredient, by the way, philosophers of war think about what counts as citizenship is the right to bear arms, and Arab-Palestinian Israelis do not have that right. And so in that sense, they're disenfranchised, since most political theorists agree that if you don't have the power to overthrow your government, your vote isn't doing a whole lot of good. So, you know, I mean, I'm not sure what paradigms we want to use for democracy. The kind of democracy that we enjoy in Canada, and I'm certainly not denying that this is a democracy, the kind of democracy that we enjoy in Canada depends very crucially on a consensus, right? I mean, the thing is that we don't have majority rule here, right? In fact, we eschew the very idea of majority rule, because if we had majority rule, there'd be all kinds of pretty oppressive things that would happen, especially under the current government. So so democracy is not simply a matter of people getting to vote. It's a matter of there being the social conditions necessary for there to be some kind of accommodation between people. And clearly that's not the case in most Middle Eastern countries. Okay. Sorry, that's a bit long-winded.
My name is Van Christou. Thank you very much, Paul, for a very lucid discussion of your topic. The question that I'd like to ask is perhaps an unfair one, in that you've never stood as a legal authority. I'm wondering, during the time that we were a colony of Britons, we went to war every time the Queen or the King told us to. Since we're no longer a colony, we think, what brings about war in a democracy like ours? Do the people have any say in it? Or is it legal for the government to go ahead and declare war the way they have?
See, this is why you should never invite a philosopher. The word legal is ambiguous between three meanings. Okay. There's a thing called natural law theory, and natural law theory says that what a law is independent of whether or not anybody thinks there is such a law. So, for example, natural law theorists will claim that it is illegal, right? It is contrary to the law of nature to rape, whether or not any society, you know, and that was the case long before any society ever had laws against rape, right? So that's called natural law theory. The second view is called legal positivism. That's the view that a law is a law just in case the people governed by it give uptake to the way in which that law was promulgated. And that is kind of the official view of Western civilization. There's another view, a third view, called legal realism. That's the view to which I subscribe, by the way. And legal realism, but I'm in the minority, okay. Legal realism is the view that a law is a law just in case you can anticipate that if you do something, here's what will happen, okay? So, for example, on the legal realist view, there is no law against so-called crimes against humanity because anybody who commits crimes against humanity cannot expect, has no reason to worry that he will be called to account for these crimes. And therefore, it's not really a crime, right? You see what I mean, right? So, it could still be an atrocity, right? But if you're contemplating, shall I commit this atrocity? And then you say to yourself, well, let's see, can I predict that I'm going to be called to account for this? And if the answer is no, then on the legal realist view, there is no, you haven't actually committed a war crime, right? You may have committed something immoral, something, you know, pretty dastardly, but you haven't really committed a crime. So here's the question. When you're talking about what the legal requirements for going to war in Canada are, they are the same as the legal, mutatis mutandis, they're the same as the legal requirements for going to war in any Western democracy. But there hasn't been a, if you want to talk legally, there hasn't been a war in which the United States has participated since 1945. Right?
Since, right?
Well, but that's clearly ridiculous. Obviously, the United States has been involved, you know, since. So whether Canada has a, you know, legal right to go to war without consulting its citizens, well, first of all, I mean, no country could have a constitution that says you have to consult your, you have to get a plebiscite before you can go to war, because by that time you will have been conquered, right? So... But I mean, I certainly take your point.
Thank you, sir. My name is John Boris. I enjoyed your presentation, and I think you expressed that you belong to some party or group that wants that democracy means certain things. Is it not a fact that what we're really arguing about, and we do this in the Western sphere, we do it with a small cost collateral damage. There's a small part, and we say we're prepared to make that be the rule. Can you tell me that we can take a different position? Because in Europe, it's all that way. It's a majority within a majority, which Canada is going to enter into as a result of things that happened yesterday. You know what I'm talking about.
In other words, we're going to go ahead
in Canada, and we're going to go ahead because this is, if you change the wording and add in Canada, it's good. If you take out in Canada, it's wrong. I don't think you can resolve problems that easy.
I have no position on the status of Quebec within.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I don't have a comment on that. I'm not. I haven't, to be quite honest. Not my issue. Sorry.
I'm Ted Mitri. I like your talk. I never miss your talk, despite what you said. I don't hate you.
Ted sometimes comes to a theology reading group, and I make part of the shtick that I have these, you know, that I hate Christians. Yeah, of course, retired priest.
After the Second World War, Nuremberg trial created a nightmare for military, which military never wants to admit that they live in a nightmare. When I was in Israel in 2003, I discovered very interesting phenomenon. Those Israeli soldiers who refuse to serve in the West Bank are punished by administrative measures, not by court-martial. Because of some precedent that happened during the 50s, when some troops, Israeli troops, committed some terrible act against Palestinians, And the court found them guilty not because of their brutality, but because they obeyed the order against their conscience, which is the application of Nuremberg trial. Therefore, nowadays, any Israeli soldier who refused to serve in the West Bank are never taken to court-martial. They are administratively punished, 6 months in jail, just like a slap in your officer. Now, I have a lot of trouble with a yellow ribbon that says support our troops in Afghanistan, because according to military traditions, troops are not supposed to have opinions. They are under civil authority. Civil authority is a supreme order of any military or democratic country. And if a soldier is committed to obeying the order of civil authority, they're not supposed to say, I'm for this war or I'm against this war, unless they believe in the principle established by Second World War trial against war criminals. What do you think?
Actually, it's a huge topic, a very interesting one, and a very
important one. I would like to point out, however, that the jurisprudence, that's the legal history that's evolved in the state of Israel, is quite peculiar, even in the Western democracies, because, most Western democracies have exemptions for conscientious objection and so on and so forth, but they do not allow for conscientious objection to the participation in a legal order, right? That is, once you're in the army, right, then it doesn't matter, whether you object to what you're doing, you have to do it, as long as it's a legal order. Whereas Tad is absolutely correct that in the state of Israel, there is in fact this legal exception that if an order is contrary to conscience, then in fact you can still be disciplined, but it is not court-martial, and that makes a huge difference between court-martial and administrative. Court-martial, for example, includes being shot, right? Whereas administrative discipline does not. There's a reason why that evolved, particularly in the state of Israel, and that's because of Israel's particular history before it became Israel. Right? You do have to remember that much of the moral sensitivities in the state of Israel, and one of the reasons why there is a crisis in the state of Israel between the doves and the hawks, is because people are aware that what's happening in the relationship with the Palestinians is that the Israelis are visiting upon the Palestinians the precise kinds of atrocities that were visited upon them in Europe under the Nazis. And so they're very sensitive about this, right? And they're trying desperately to maintain a modern nation state without at the same time turning into, National Socialist Germany, right? Which is, feeling it's the state of Israel, of course, feeling itself being impinged from all sides, from 200 or 100 million Arabs and so on. So, it's a very, very precarious and difficult situation. I just want those of you who think that there is no reflection within the state of Israel or within the Jewish community about these matters, there are Jews, probably about, unfortunately, they don't form a majority in the state of Israel, but there are Jews in the state of Israel and outside the state of Israel, myself included, who are very concerned about things like what happened in Cana, what happened in Beit Hanun just 2 weeks ago. Certainly what happened in 1982 in Sabra and Shatila and the refugee camps. Jews have a particular historical reason for being particularly sensitive about this, but they're caught between a rock and a hard place. Tad is dead right that the jurisprudence, that is to say the legal history that's evolved, I think has evolved precisely because of the particular history of the Jewish people. I don't know if that helps.
What about Canadian troops?
Canadian troops don't have that option. If you're dumb enough to join the army.
I'm Trevor Page. Thanks very much for your provocative presentation. I don't disagree with any of your conclusions. I'm not sure I'd have gotten there the same way. I think I need to meet your ex-wife. I may well be the English hedgehog that you referred to. But I have spent 30 years with the UN in the countries that we're talking about, Afghanistan, Sudan, etc. But I'd like to bring the debate back to Afghanistan and whether we should quit or not. I say we should. We should quit now. There is no gain for Canada in Afghanistan at this time. What we went in to do as part of a coalition is not what is happening now. It's quite different. And I do have to say that the deputy ambassador of Canada in Afghanistan, with whom I discussed this recently, fully agrees with this. There is no gain for Canada in Afghanistan militarily. It's not a question of should we support our troops or not. It's a wrong foreign policy. And soldiers are there actually to carry out the foreign policy, not to make it. So I say we should quit. But the only reason or the only way we're going to be able to is through people power. Unless we write to our MPs, to our MLAs, to our government, unless we show ourselves and are out on the streets, it's not going to happen. Because the deal was done between Chrétien and George Bush. We'll take care of Iraq. You, Canada, take care of Afghanistan. That was reinforced recently with this two-year extension. Nobody says that Canada shouldn't do its NATO duty. But to go up and take on a couple of extra years is going to result in exactly what you're predicting. So I say, you say you don't know whether we should quit. I say we should, and we should do it now. And the only way we can do it is through people. Would you like to comment?
Yeah, I think the reason why I'm not sure personally about what Canada should do with respect to this, with respect to our foreign policy, is I am not sufficiently familiar with the implications for our relations with our allies. So I don't know. I mean, certainly we have examples of countries that pulled out of either Afghanistan or Iraq. Spain would be an example of one, which pulled out a couple of days after the resistance managed to bomb the Madrid train station. Brilliant strategy, by the way, I think. And I'm not sure that there have been devastating consequences for Spain as a result of that pullout, but I'm not sure what our relations are with our allies in terms of what kinds of consequences would in fact result. I don't know, for example, whether or not in the next round of, whether it be, tariff negotiations and so on and so forth, whether or not that will cost us. And I don't know how much it'll cost us. So, again, I mean, I tossed out this provocative figure at $60 million per body bag. Well, that seems fairly cheap. That price might go down. In other words, the return on each body bag might go down, and if that's the case, we might want to rethink our position. But I have to be honest, I'm not qualified to make that kind of judgment call. I worry, of course, that our leaders aren't either. But
Terry Shillington, thank you very much for your remarks. Although, like Tad, I'm not sure how many of them I agree with. But I'd like to go back to a remark I think I heard you make right at the beginning, in which you assumed that I think remarked that most Canadians felt we should be in Afghanistan, or that was a good cause to begin with.
In the first place,
yeah. Well, as I recall, after 9/11, Americans decided they would make America safe, and that led them to Iraq and to Afghanistan, although I think in the other order. I don't know whether a philosopher of war will agree with this, but I think wars seldom make people safe. And in this particular case, with the hills and valleys of Afghanistan and Iraq, I think Americans are coming to realize that neither of these exercises have made America safe, but quite the contrary. And so perhaps the whole assumption on which got us there is that war will make us safe was a fallacy, and that if Americans had said, well, let's sit down and talk with one another and talk about our grievances, perhaps the world would have been a lot safer than these military adventures.
Thanks, Terry. The Bush administration is claiming, of course, that by virtue of the fact that there hasn't been a repetition of 9/11, this proves that the occupation of these countries, in fact, is paying off, which is a kind of odd kind of reasoning. Reminds me very much of, I think most of you might remember this ad. Do you remember there was an ad for The Bay? This was like 30 years ago or 20, 30 years ago. And the guy comes on. He was a character from Laugh-In. And he holds up a pair of running shoes. He says, "These are my chicken of the forest shoes. When I wear these shoes, the chicken of the forest cannot get me." See? It worked. it was very funny, and we all laughed, and so on. The thing is that the Bush administration's reasoning that there hasn't been another 9/11 proves that our occupation of Gaza, the West Bank, Iraq, and Afghanistan are, in fact, keeping us safe. Barcelona's in Spain. London is in England, okay? Right. Let them take the brunt. Well, we haven't been hit yet, right? I'm sorry, I have to agree. I don't think that this war is making us any safer. I think, in fact, it's just perpetuating the... but there are some people who are making a lot of money out of it, and let's, including, by the way, us. So let's remember that, right? So when you do all the calculations, it might turn out that think of 1984, right? And in 1984, in the novel 1984, you manufacture enemies. But the thing about manufacturing enemies is it not only keeps you a cohesive society, but at the same time it keeps your economy running, right? Again, I'm not an economist, and I'm not an empirical economist in any event. And so, you might have to look and actually look at the details of the payoffs here. Can I just make one more comment about that? You see, good social policy does not depend necessarily on evidence-based reasoning. And a perfect example of this is this. I remember about 2 years ago during the mad cow crisis, right, here in Alberta, the Minister of Agriculture, whose name I can't remember, she was a woman, she said, look, we might have to cull the herd. We might have to kill a couple hundred thousand Alberta cattle, right? And someone says, well, would that actually reduce the incidence of mad cow? And she said, not one iota, but it'll improve people's confidence in the cattle supply. So you see, I mean, you might think, well, wait a minute. Like, originally I wanted to say, that's just dumb. But on the other hand, look, if people are dumb enough to think, right, that killing off, 200 is going to save, then maybe that's the right thing to do. Because good social policy dovetails with just how stupid we are, right? So...
Bob Anderson, following up on your concept about people being dumb enough, the other morning at the Senior Center, they put out a monthly or something publication, and the headline was something like, Support the War Effort. It read like it was something after the First or Second World War. But that's where we are now. Same sort of thing. Now, that's obviously been brought about by, I think, a fairly clever strategy by our Prime Minister in the way he maneuvers around his speakers and having Karzai here. And I mean, he's orchestrating this whole situation. But I'd like you to comment on the...
how dumb we really are.
briefly.
Well, first of all, no one's dumber
than me, by the way. I mean, I tell my students, I said, look, if you want an A, right, don't agree with me. Just show me why I'm wrong, because I always am. It just takes me a couple of years to figure out why I'm wrong, right? You know? So I certainly didn't mean that as some kind of, but I'm not dumb. You know? I do want to make one comment about how propaganda works. Some people think that propaganda is something imposed on you, right? So you are propagandized, right? That's not always true. Oftentimes we cooperate with our own being propagandized because we need to get our blood boiling in order to do what we know we have to do for all the, for perhaps all the wrong reasons, but, we need to get our blood boiling. And so there's a sense in which many of us cooperate, not at a conscious level, but at an unconscious level. I do not believe that the American people are as dumb as they would have to be if we took the American propaganda at face value. I don't believe that. I think they're almost, but not quite, as well educated as we are, Canadians. I say almost, but not quite. But I think that they realize that there are certain things that they need to do, which if they kind of, allowed themselves to argue it on the ground, it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, but they know they have to do it anyhow. And so what they do is they allow themselves to buy that kind of propaganda. Well, I think what they need to do in this case is they need that oil. They need to control that oil supply. If you have any doubts about that, talk to my colleague Kent Peacock, who knows a great deal about just about the Hubbard curve and so on. So I think the American people know they need that oil, and I think that whatever it takes to get their blood boiling enough that they can go over there and take it, they're going to do. And I don't think that, because I'm a good Hobbesian, that may not necessarily be such a wrong thing, right? I mean, sometimes we have to do the same things. We do the same things ourselves, right? You have to get your blood boiling in order to get to do something. And so you have to kind of manufacture and justifications. And so when somebody offers you a justification, yeah, that's right. We're going in there to save the women, right, or whatever we have to do. So I think that's how propaganda works. We're not victims of it. We are the authors of it ourselves. And I think we should be sometimes sensitive to that. Right?
Hi, my name's Austin Fennell. I have a question that has to do with how you feel about both the sides being really ideologically driven and whether within both of them you see signs of those ideologies crumbling. If the one, for instance, represents a certain view about how the culture and society should be organized and its religious partners, and the other also believing that it might be driven essentially by economic need or its secular commitments with his own religious connection. And yet within our own side, we can be incensed that 42 Canadians have been killed, but you're proposing to 100,000 Afghan will die, but that doesn't bother us the same way. What does that say about the threatened collapse of our own ideology? There's two questions in there, or more.
Yeah, I'm just trying to sort them up in my head here.
Good question.
I think in order to distinguish the propaganda about the ideology versus the facts about the ideology, you really do have to watch Al Jazeera. Okay. Now, the West has attempted to portray the Muslim resistance to Western occupation as driven by some kind of religious fanaticism and so on and so forth. That's not the way the Muslim community represents its motivations to itself. And if you want to see that, you have to watch Al Jazeera, which I regularly do. You can get it, by the way, just on, all you got to do is just Google it and you're there, right? And it's in English now. By the way, here there's something else that you might want to know is that, this is really not my job to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you this. There's a program on Google. So as long as you've got Google, you just go Google Tools, You can highlight anything in Arabic or Italian, in my case, you know, because I have this courting an Italian woman. You can Google, you can highlight it, dump it into this online Google tool, and press Arabic to English or English to Arabic or whatever, and instantly, boom, you got it. Now, it does come out in a kind of a funny, English, right? So you can get pretty much everything that the Middle East, the Arab world is getting, you can get it in English that way. Okay. They do not represent themselves this way. We have all these kind of, this talk about suicide bombers. Well, you know, like nobody's a suicide bomber. The last thing you want is one of your soldiers to commit suicide in the process. What you want to do is deliver the bomb. And if that takes, you know, carrying it in, well, okay, but you'd much rather, would you not, that the bomb went off and by some miraculous coincidence of the way it was charged, everybody else gets killed in this room, but I walk away to do it another time, right? I mean, so suicide bombing is a term that a propaganda term. Here's another one. You'll notice that the Israelis refer to the Hezbollah people that they've captured, right, as prisoners of war, but they refer to, and you've all heard this, the Canadian media, by the way, participates in this. Do you notice that those two soldiers that were taken by Hezbollah that precipitated this the war in the summer, they were kidnapped?
I mean, soldiers don't kidnap each other, do they?
So, if you just think about all of the language that's being used here, right? This is the language of ideology. But I think that that's part of the propaganda. We're trying to portray the Arab world as if somehow Arab people aren't just like you and me. They just want to raise their families and, play soccer with their kids and send them to university if they want to go. I mean, they're just folk, just like you and me. They don't actually walk around with any kind of, different priority set of Maslow's hierarchies than we do. Right? That's all propaganda. So, but again, as I said with response to my last comment, we might need that propaganda in order to keep our blood boiling so that we can go off and kill Arabs. Right? If that's what you need, you have to vilify, dehumanize the enemy. You have to make Arabs something different from us in order to kill them. Right? Anyway.
One last question.
Oh, you're blocked.
Comments briefly.
Mine is short and sweet. Gene Fennell here. If the NATO commitment in Afghanistan is finished in 2007, and if Stephen Harper said Canada will stay till 2009, will Canada be alone in Afghanistan?
If Canada were alone in Afghanistan, there would be no Canadians left in Afghanistan in about 4 days, I figure. So, no, Canada will not be alone in Afghanistan. Notice that this really just follows from the axioms I told you about in battle, right? You're in battle. The more people who run from your line, the more rational it is for you to run too. Because if you're the only one there holding the line to cover their back, chances are you're going to be dead. And I think that any Canadian commander will know that. If everybody else leaves, we will leave. But I don't think that's going to happen.
One more quick question.
Okay.
She was up first.
Thank you very much for your talk.
Besides the intellectual stimulation, what we learned, it was also hilarious.
It's you know, a trait. We Jews are just funnier than you Gentiles.
Okay, a war is an exercise of power. If you're going to go into a war, you mobilize and you win the damn thing. We had no doubt about that whatsoever in World War II. We knew what we were going to do. We knew what we had to do. We mobilized all the resources we could. Now we're in a war in Afghanistan, but we could solve all the problems in Afghanistan if the Allies or UN or whoever we are had 1 million troops. mobilize and win the damn thing. But our motives are mixed. And as far as pulling out, us Canadians are so nice that it bothers us. We hate to abandon that 50% of the population in Afghanistan that are going to have awful things done to them by the other 50%. Where we hate to think of the little girls in Afghanistan not being able to go to school. And so we mix up all of the humanitarian stuff with the essential stuff, which is winning a war.
Thank you. I mean, you raise an important point that, in fact, is the subject of considerable debate in the United States right now, which is simply this. Afghanistan is that's unwinnable. But take Iraq. Some Americans were advocating many years ago, before during the time of the invasion,
that you need more boots on the ground. Now, it's certainly true if you sent about 1 million American troops to occupy Iraq, then at least while you're occupying Iraq, right, you know, the problem will be solved. Of course, you have to stay there in perpetuity. Right? That's the problem, right? I don't think that there is any way that there's any way that you can solve the problem either in Afghanistan or Iraq or Darfur or Palestine by simply occupying, because when you pull out, the problems are still there and you're going to be right back to where you started from. So. Thank you
very much.
Thank you for inviting me. Very, very good question.
We've been challenged and informed, and so thank you very much, Paul. With that, we will adjourn and reconvene next Thursday, where we will hear a presentation on the Nikoyoko Gardens. Oh, also, sorry, thank you, Austin. We would ask you to, if you have other, to visit our website, SACPA website, www.sacpa.ca, where these remarks you heard today will be posted, and you can also add your comments or questions if you want to continue this discussion. Thank you very much.